speaker is Diana B.
My name is Diana, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Charlie for asking me to share here tonight. He reminded me that my entire AA reputation rests on this talk. He says it's fine when you go talk in San Bernardino or someplace, but here you got to be careful. It is a truly amazing thing that I can get up here relatively safe and sane, and of course sober, and talk, because this was the thing that terrified me the most. The fear and self-obsession. Of course, I didn't know the word self-obsession. I just knew that I was filled with dread and worry and fear, and it seemed to get more intense as I got older and as life got more complicated, and it focused all on the speaking in front of a group or having to talk in class or having to even answer a question in class. Dread and impending doom seemed to be real strong suits that I had. I worried a lot when I was a kid about animal cruelty. I didn't have any animals or anything, but I just would lie in bed and think how terrible people are and how awful it is. And then when I got a little older, I worried a lot. I had terrible sadness and misery about the Middle Ages. Awful things happened. They didn't have anesthetic. And they had all those wars, and they didn't know what to do. And so I would brood and worry about that. I had the combination of things that I've come to understand in the years that I've been hearing people share at meetings. I'm starting to get some understanding of this. I had the two ingredients that make me an alcoholic. I had that uncomfortable neighborhood that our former speaker talked about in my head. I had scary bad feelings. I had constant thoughts about myself. I heard Paul, I think, Paul O on tape once say that he thinks one of the main deficits of the alcoholics is that they're unable to express love. And I was certainly unable to think about love or express it or have any interest in it because I was so worried about myself. I was so worried about what other people were thinking about me, or that scary things were happening and that there was some authority that was going to come and yell at me and that I was doing something wrong. And that was such a continuous state that I began to think it would be wonderful to be drunk. When I was a young kid, it seemed like a really good idea to get drunk because then you're not expected to act right. And so one of the first points in all of this was a birthday party I was taken out to when I was 12 years old. It was brought up in Chicago. I was taken to the Palmer House Hotel, very fancy. And I remember very clearly my focus on the drink that they let me order there. It was one of those frothy ones. And I wanted a second, and they were all kind of nervous and worried that I wanted a second. And I wasn't interested in anything that was going on except having that second drink. And I was so interested in it. And so that was the world of the evening. And that was, I only half joke when I say I seem to have put together the notion of drinking and how to drink when I was in a former lifetime. Because it was full blown. I was ready to go. I loved the idea of getting relief of how I felt and what I feared. And so the next turning point, with the bleakness and with the scariness and the fear, the brooding and stuff that was going on all the time, it seemed wonderful in a philosophy class when I read this 3-page article on scientific materialism. Introduction to philosophy class there when I was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin, and they said that the only thing you can know anything about is things that you can measure and quantify, and that everything else is a figment of the imagination, and it's all made up and silly and confabulated by people who are weak and can't put up with, etc. And I went for that. I had a violent atheist conversion. The world fell into place. And it was like reaching for the void. It was like going for the bleak, accepting it, wanting it, yes. And so I could continue to have black and scary thoughts and know that those were the right thoughts, because that's how the universe really was. And I had a sign next to my desk when I was in college that said nihil ex nihilo in Latin, which means nothing comes of nothing. And I could really get going on that. I loved to just wax hysterical about how there was nothing in the void, and I would get very contemptuous and cynical when anybody would talk about anything about God or anything like that. And I was, this was quite a long time ago in the Midwest when it was really not fashionable. I also liked negative attention, and I certainly got it with that rap. I could pull that one out at parties and start to drink and start talking about that and get a lot of attention and be cool. And so that led on to trying to analyze things and doing philosophy and philosophy of this and philosophy of that and feeling worse and worse, and it was a kind of a fake suicide attempt in there. That was the one where I called the boyfriend up and told him I'd cut my wrists, and then I figured I'd better do it. Ruth King used to talk about her sick need to look good. And that got me schlepped off to the student locked psychiatry ward, which is not what anybody in my family had in mind when they sent me off to college. And I spent a week in there crying. Every time I got a letter from home, I would cry. Everything was just closing in on me. Nothing was working out the way I thought it should in college. And all the way through college, I was an opportunistic drinker. It was a wonderful thing to be able to drink. I always drank a lot very fast. I never once took a social drink. I saw no reason to. I thought drinking was wonderful. And all this time, this fear was building up, and I started to see a psychiatrist 3 times a week during this time. And we talked about a lot of things. I just remembered that being in a hostile universe takes so many different forms. I told him about when I was adolescent, and my folks bought a whole bunch of horseback riding lessons, got me that for a birthday. And I remember telling him that I got into this topic of, I felt like all the horses hated me. And he said, how long have you felt that horses hate you? And with feeling so bad and wrong all the time, that was it. It got projected on everything. And that with this terrible longing, and I heard people share about how they would stalk around looking for something, and I would stalk through the campus at night, and I would look for something, someone, usually end up picking somebody up to take the edge off all of this terrible internal anguish and wrongness. And I graduated from college. We called it the Great Abyss at that time, because it was really nothing to do with liberal arts major. What the heck are you going to do with that? And I was about to marry Fred. We always come to Fred at this point. I was about to marry Fred the philosopher, my fellow logical positivist. And we talked about how the only way you can know about anything is by analyzing the words that talk about it. That's it. Or maybe write out some logical symbols. That would be good, too. And I really felt I had tried everything I could think of, and that the only thing that maybe now this marriage would get some meaning in my life. And I discovered that Fred was sneaking upstairs to hang out with Brenda. Brenda had been one of the ones we used to play bridge with. We used to make fun of her, call her names and stuff. I don't know if the whole thing was a ruse, but he was ending up sneaking upstairs to see Brenda. And this was the last straw. Everything I thought could ever work had turned to ashes and dust. Every idea I had, everything I thought was good, as soon as I did it, it just became fraudulent and empty. And so now when this situation fell apart, I had the wind blowing through the empty hole in the gut that we hear people talk about. And for the first time, it occurred to me that I could buy a bottle on the way home from work. I had very few self-care skills. I didn't know how to solve anything. I didn't know how to fix myself. This was another great yes. This was as good as becoming an atheist. It was a yes to alcohol. There it is. That is it. It is always there for me. I don't have to just wait. I always think of the analogy of the Neanderthals probably waited until the lightning struck so that a tree would burn and then they could cook some meat. And after a few centuries of that, one day they figured out that they could make their own fire. And that's just how that was to me. It was a massive revelation that I could go in a liquor store and buy my own alcohol, and that started me on daily drinking. I went through that bottle of cream sherry that night. I was been out of college for about a year. I just stopped seeing the psychiatrist. We broke up after 5 years. We decided I still had a problem with speaking in front of a group, food, and sex. Other than that, things were fine. And this was a true solution, because now every day I knew I was going to get relief. Every day from this pressure, this dread, this now I know the word self-obsession. I knew I was going to have a tiny bit of relief. And I, in fact, had quite a bit of relief. It worked wonderfully. I had that connection with the universe, the okayness. Sometimes I would still feel the badness and trouble and dread, and knew things weren't working out, and I knew that I couldn't develop relationships decently, and I knew that I really didn't know what to do in life, and I knew all these things. But after I started drinking, I didn't care. I knew these things would be true, but they didn't bother me. And that was wonderful. There was no better thing than that. I think it's brilliant to drink when you feel miserable and you're an alcoholic and it works for you. it's an excellent idea for a while, until it stopped working, of course. And it did work for me for quite a while. I could get very drunk, pass out, wake up pretty refreshed, and go on into a day. And then the trouble would start to build up in the course of the day. Impending doom, all of that. When am I going to make something of myself? Or fighting with someone. I had married a person that I was working for who was a lot older than I was, and I was babysitting for his kids one night while he and his wife went off to Milwaukee for a party in the winter, and there was a head-on collision, and the wife died in the night, and I was the one to tell the kids their mother had died. And I knew that we would be married in a year. And it was felt that I needed some credentials to marry this person. So I was shipped off to school to get one. And I was on the south side of Chicago. And I discovered there that when I drank every night, I really studied much better. It cleared my mind. I had so much fear of those classes. I was so afraid somebody was going to call on me. I dropped a class that I was very excited about when I learned that the whole thing you had to do was get up and give a talk at the end of the quarter. I walked around for 3 days, stunned in panic over that. How can I do that? I had to drop the class, and of course there's that terrible feeling of failure, and I could take all of those feelings away every night by drinking. I was drinking a lot, drinking strong things. One night I was also taking care of the son in this family that I was going to get married into, the 3-year-old. I was taking care of him in this one-room apartment. And one night I got a sitter, and I went to meet an old boyfriend in Chicago. And I took the train, and I met him, and we drank a whole lot and caroused and carried on. And I got on the train to come back, and I passed out, heading to about 162nd Street on the south side, very tough area, about 6 inches of glass all over the ground, and and I woke up about 3:30 in the morning and realized I was very far away from where I was going to go. And I got off the train and I stood there in the dark on the train platform. And I was lucky; a train came by about 20 minutes later and took me back the other way. And that was one of many, many. Every time I drank, I got to something like that. Every time. I either passed out of my own house, or if I was somewhere, if I was at a party, I'd go over and try and play the Moonlight Sonata, which I hadn't played since I was 12. Everybody would gather around the piano, and of course, what goes when you're drinking are your motoric abilities and your memory. And so I'd get a few measures into Moonlight Sonata, and everybody would laugh nervously, kind of drift back away from the piano. It started not working. As they say in Chicago AA, even the alcohol stopped working. I didn't mind so much when they drifted away from the piano, but really scary things started to happen. Car accidents,
fighting at home. There were three kids in Rhode Island. I was drinking every night, every night. I had this 4 o'clock thing. If I didn't drink till 4, it was cocktails. That's how I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. So I held off usually till something with 4 in it. 29 to 4, you know, that was good. And one night there was one of these nice parties, the colleagues of the person I was married to, and I acted in very obnoxious ways, and he took me home, and he took me upstairs to the bedroom to get my clothes off, and I was the belligerent type. How dare you? How dare you to act this way toward me? I can do anything I want. Leave me alone, that type of... And he tried to get my clothes off, and he left for a few minutes, and I took... he had bought me a very beautiful dress a couple of months before, one of these couture beautiful things, and I went in the bathroom and got a double-edged razor blade and slashed the whole thing to shreds, and of course also cut my hand all over so there was blood and shreds of dress all over, and I broke my earrings and threw them, and I woke up to see that the next morning. It made for a very hard day, those things happening again and again. And yet, it never occurred to me to stop drinking. I couldn't imagine life without drinking. The darkness, the hideousness, the monsters crawling around in there, no, that was not going to be a possibility. I enrolled in school a lot. I would go enroll in school again. Go do the thing that scared me the most. Go to class where I have to talk to people. So I did that there, and that would keep me distracted and worried and panicky. And he was offered, the person I was, ex-husband was offered a job here. And so we moved here in 1971. And the culture shock and the fact that I was well along now with alcoholic drinking, daily drinking, I could never get through a day without drinking. And my freedom and happiness were involved with drinking. I used to love to get very drunk when he was gone and slam dance, I guess they call it now, around the house and bonk off the furniture and crash around, and nobody could say anything to me. I could just be free and make great big pancakes and pour bourbon all over them and eat those and. I was hearing a lot of funny noises, too, around that time. I would lie in my bed in the morning. It was no longer pleasant to wake up in the morning. I felt sick and miserable and viscous and sort of stuck to the bed, like I couldn't move. Just couldn't move. And I would lie there wondering, why are they dropping ball bearings in my driveway? Because there was a sound that could only be that. It went, deep. And then it would be quiet for a few minutes, and it would a little higher. That's when they drop it from a higher point. And I'd recently moved into this new house in California, and I would wake up and I would lie there and I would wonder, why are they dropping ball bearings in my driveway? Years later, somebody told me those were mockingbirds. The sound of my stepson's spoon on his cereal bowl about 5 rooms and 1 long hall away would drive me insane in the morning, too. I'd lie there, I'd hear that spoon hit that bowl. I think, I'm going to go insane. I had a lot of problem with when and whether to drive. My own feeling was, if I couldn't walk, that was not really a problem, because you don't need to walk to drive. But I had a lot of flack from this person I was married to about that. He didn't like me especially driving the children around, so we had a lot of tension and trouble about that. And I started to notice this pancake behavior. Making these great big pancakes the size that you would make for a Boy Scout camp seemed to me to be really weird. And also, I really felt hideous in the morning after all that stuff. So I figured that my problem was eating. I had an eating problem. And I was kind of stomping around UCLA just trying to figure out what to do next now that I'd come to California. And I found a woman, heard of a woman, one person that I talked to. I didn't talk to anybody. You can't talk to people. You know, but they say, how was your evening? Oh, I started about 4, well, maybe 20 to 4 this time. I held out to 20 to 4. I started with the really strong stuff that I kept in the freezer because I don't want to use ice because ice ruins a drink. And so that was really strong and thick and good. And then I started a couple bottles of, you know, the dinner wine, and pretending that I cared about the wine when, of course, the only thing that I ever was interested in was quantity. And then there was the after-dinner stuff, and then there was all the... Then I slipped into the brandies and the brandy and the milk, and then I made the pancakes and put the brandy and the bourbon on the pancake. Thank you. How was your evening? You can't talk about what you're doing. And I was very, very compartmentalized. I was very secretive, and I'd carefully calculate everything I'd say, and then if I said something a little bit wrong, I'd know that they're starting to notice, so I'd have to change it and say something different. Plan my personality and plan my commentaries, and it's very exhausting. It's hard to have a nice, relaxing friendship that way. And so one person, though, that I did talk to, and actually it was a group I'd gone to help people who have a hopeless, intractable terror of speaking in front of a group. And I talked to her for a few minutes, and she told me about Overeaters Anonymous. And that clicked. I knew about this eating problem that I had. And it took me about a year, but I turned up of doing this over and over and millions of times, and every time crashing around the house and fighting about the driving and waking up sick and wondering about the ball bearings and the bleeding gums and the car accidents and the doctors saying there's something horribly wrong with this woman, but we don't know what it is. One doctor asked me, do you drink? I said, I put myself out every night. He said, I see. And so I turned up at an Overeaters Anonymous meeting, and that was somewhere in 1972. And eventually I bought a big book at one of those meetings. And I knew that all of that crazy eating happened at about the 17th drink. I knew that. And I knew the 17th came after the 16th. And I counted back, you know, 12th came after the 11th. You keep counting back. And you know that the 17th comes after the first drink. I figured that out. I never stopped after the first. It would be ridiculous. I hate the thought of the first drink. Or of one drink. And so I stopped drinking for a while to get this eating thing in order. And I wanted to get myself in order so I could drink like a normal person. This was such a strong desire. I wanted to be able to drink right. I didn't want to get so crazy when I drank. I wanted to be able to drink right. I did not want to stop drinking, but I was willing to shelve it just for a little while. And but I started to see myself in that book there. I started to identify the director and the person who will either lean or lead and cannot be a worker among workers. And I read the stories, and I felt the power and strength of them, and I was pulled into that book. I had a lot of opinions about the writing, you know, of course, but I was pulled by the beautiful, wonderful content. And after not drinking for a while, I had a dinner party, and in an unplanned fashion, I drank one glass of wine. Now, that pitched me into mental obsession in its purest form, because I was pretty physically in better shape, because I hadn't had anything to drink for a while. But all I could think about was, what does this mean? It was like red ants crawling through my brain. For 2 days, it's all I thought about. What does this mean? How much am I going to get to drink? Am I, let's see now, if between 4 and 7 maybe, if it's a dinner party, there can be one, and I'd know, but that's maybe 4:30. You better say 4:30. Just constantly grinding and going and carrying on. And I almost had it figured out that it would just be dinner, and it would just be the certain type of stuff in a certain type of glass, and that's how I keep it up. And I just about believed that I'd had it where I could accept, and I would be able to follow through. And then the thought came, but what if there's a late buffet? I had no defense against a late buffet. I knew it. That thought drove me to my first AA meeting, where I put my hand up. I went in and I asked them if it was okay to drink one glass of wine. It's amazing how long it takes to understand these things. And somebody looked at me in a very straight way and said, there's no doubt anybody in the room here would say you drank. So I was still the rationalizing, my case is different, oh, that's not important, oh, that doesn't matter type of thinker when it came to alcohol, and I wanted to lighten up, I wanted to smooch through. But there was an honesty and a non-judgmentalness there that was very, very attractive to me. And the next meeting I went to was Tuesday Night Pacific Group. I got hooked up with a sponsor, and I got on the road, and that was May 13th. Last drink was May 13th, 1973. Now, I certainly had many reasons why I thought my case was different. I really wanted to figure things out. I wanted to figure things out with philosophy and the scientific method, and I was studying the brain at the time that I got sober. I just started doing that about a year or so before. That was going to be the answer to everything. And I knew I was in neuroanatomy class, and I was dissecting it, and I could tell you where the emotions were. At least that's what people told me. That's where they were. Emotions, certain kind of emotions are here, and certain kind of memory things are here, and thoughts are here, and associations are here, and they're all right here. And I knew this, and I knew about, went to classes on psychiatric disturbance and classes on neurological disorders, and I was learning all these things. And then I would come to a meeting, and somebody would say, if you turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand God, you will begin to recover. And I thought, how could the third step prayer do anything with this other way I had of thinking about things, this way of the physical brain? And those two lives were very compartmentalized for a long time. I was very drawn to AA. It was the only place I was comfortable. When I stopped drinking and put my hand up as an alcoholic and made a surrender, there was no fooling around anymore. There was all this dread and fear and horror and anxiety that had been masked over by drinking all those years came up and sat there right in my face, right in my head. I couldn't sit still anywhere. There was terrible tension at home. I was jealous of the other graduate students. I felt terrible and inferior every place I went. And so it drove me to meetings feeling that bad. And of course, I've learned to be grateful for anxiety now, for the pain and suffering of getting sober, because I had so many reservations. I felt I couldn't do anything that had anything to do with the God thing, because my identity was of a person who wouldn't even say that word. And many of you have heard us say probably ad nauseum, Marilyn and I say that we met about this time, and we had a lot of similar attitudes here, a lot of similar background. Marilyn S., your former secretary, and we talked many hours over the phone, and we could listen to each other, and we could get each other through another day. And one time I was told to get on my knees because of this tension I was feeling. It was the anxiety, it was the bee in the bottle, just tension, nervous tension all the time. People call me on, they tell me they're anxious and they're surprised about it. I was that way for years and years. And I was told to get on my knees and say thank you for keeping me safe, sane, and sober in the morning, or ask to be kept safe, sane, and say thank you at the end of the day. And I did that, and I started to feel some relief. And I developed a little hypothesis for a while there that getting on your knees has direct action on the nuclei of the limbic system, causing some... A little while later, I was sitting in a lecture on frontal lobotomy. I've always been fascinated by frontal lobotomies. I had a feeling that that's kind of what alcohol did. It would give me a temporary reversible frontal lobotomy, because it would just cut off all of that caring so efficiently. And I realized that I had this world of school and learning about these things on the one hand, and I had this spiritual life that was evolving in the first couple of years of sobriety on the other hand, and the two were so far apart, and they came together and they started to kind of like two big balloons kind of crash against one another, and it caused a terrific psychic upheaval, just like it says in the big book can happen. It says subterranean rearrangements can happen, and it says that the changing that we have to do in building the new foundation, the complete new foundation, being on the spiritual path can sometimes be, and I quote, unbelievably painful. And of course, pain is a touchstone of spiritual growth, is the other thing it said. And I went through several months, it may have been a year, I don't know, but of very, very strange things, I'd be on campus at UCLA, and it would be like it was undulating, and I was on a different planet, and it was all this unreality and swinging around, and I talked to people, I talked to Marilyn, who had gone through a similar thing, and she assured me that if I just keep going to meetings, I talked to other people, and I'm very grateful that I rode that out, because then when other shocking things came along, I could ride them out too, and in my experience, it's been an essential part of recovery to have times that feel very, very confusing and wrong. And that's really part of it. I heard the expression somewhere, pain can mean something good is happening. And that's really been my experience. The marriage didn't last. We went our separate ways, and I went off to Chicago. I left L.A., went to Chicago. It took me a while to get used to Chicago AA. But I really felt the whole time there that the purpose for being there was to work the 11 steps, through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. And I did it in that aggressive, enthusiastic way that an alcoholic can do it. I did a little bit of everything. I did the smorgasbord of spiritual possibilities. I listened to Rajneesh and Ram Dass and Satchidananda and Krishnamurti, and I went to a seminar and Thomas Merton, and I took a class on Science, Man, and God at the Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, and I went to classes at St. John's Episcopal Seminary, which is where Alan Watts was years ago. He left because he refused to kneel. He said it was undignified. And it was a thrilling time. It was very, very frightening, though, because I had pushed all of that out of my life because there was something very terrifying about it. I think it was the unworthiness. I think it's the inability to love and unworthiness, the inability to experience the love of God and to have any confidence that there could be a loving God because of deep, deep unworthiness. And so sometimes I would go in one of the Christian churches just to try on a Sunday morning, and I would walk in, I would sit down, they would start singing their hymns, and I would just start to cry. And there'd be a nice middle class families around, and they look over and this woman just crying and sobbing through the hymn, and then they'd do the sermon and they sing some more hymns, and I'd start to cry and sob again, and then it would be over and I'd go out and shake the minister's hand. I didn't know what that was about, but to open up to all these new things had a lot of time of perhaps it was some kind of surrender, deep surrender, healing, deep healing. Something was happening, but after that time, I felt that was finished. That journey was finished. I'd explored all kinds of things. I'd done formal meditation, the kind where they hit you on the shoulder with a stick and you thank them. I had opened up, read many things, and now when I came back to Los Angeles in 81, it seemed like it was time to, and I'd always stayed very close to AA, but now it seemed that AA was my religion. I was thinking about it tonight. It's like AA is beyond religion. And one time I went over to one of the priests in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told him, I'm having these thoughts, I'm having these feelings, this sense, I guess you could call it conscious contact or something, but it's not like anything they told me about when I was in the Lutheran church as a child. There was nothing like that. And he said, ah, you're experiencing the God beyond God. And that was very dramatic and wonderful to me. I've had many things happen in the last 20, almost 22 years that I've been sober. Alcoholics Anonymous has always been there. I was involved in a very intense friendship, I guess you could say, a very close, distant relationship that was causing me a lot of conflict and confusion. And when I came back to L.A. from North Dakota, I asked Clancy to be my sponsor. And here I had this trouble and this confusion, and I would wear Marilyn's ear out about it day after day. And so one day I wrote an inventory and went down to the mission, and Clancy shut the door and listened. And it was a wonderful experience to see Alcoholics Anonymous work on everything like that. He talked to me, he set me at ease in a way that it's never been a problem since then. I was asked a couple of weeks ago I was invited last summer to go a couple of weeks ago to a Midwestern university and give in my work, which I've stayed in. I've managed to keep doing this kind of work that I liked when I was first sober. Couldn't do any of it in the beginning, the first couple of years. I couldn't do anything but sit at my desk and stare at it. But eventually that's gotten better. And so I was asked to come and give a lecture. I was going to be a guest. It was an all-university lecture. Then I was scheduled all day to meet with students and speak in some classes. And I did it, and I enjoyed it. They were so nice to me. On Sunday when I first got there, I all day thought I'd better call Clancy and tell him they're being so nice to me. I don't know what to do. And then I remembered that what I'm supposed to do is act the part that they invited me there to be. And it turned out it really wasn't about me. And it was so easy to go and be of service and do the thing that I've been trained to do, to listen to the students, to be interested in them. And you really can't get here from there, from the horrible fear and terror I had that people would look at me or that I would do something wrong, that the paralyzing fear that I had about doing anything like that, where I would have had to practice and work and obsess for a year to be able to do something like that. You know, I just got on the airplane and did it, and I knew that why should I put myself down and feel like a fraud? They don't think so. Why don't I just take the actions and do what I'm supposed to do here? And as your 10-minute speakers both said, everything that I can do in life, I've learned to do here. I still love the Middle Ages. I'm still fascinated by the Middle Ages. But now I enjoy the music. I enjoy the literature. I sing in an early music group. We perform a couple concerts every year. And all of that terrible fear and dread that was always associated with that is gone. It's one of the many, many miracles. As I stay sober and stay here, and particularly being a member now of the Pacific Group, I am more and more amazed about what AA has to offer, this wonderful adventure of sobriety. Thank you for listening.